It's January 9th, 2007, Moscone Center, San Francisco. Steve Jobs is standing on a stage in a black turtleneck, and he's about to show the audience three devices, an iPod, a phone, an internet communicator. He repeats the list, an iPod, a phone, an internet communicator. He repeats it a third time, grinning, letting the crowd catch up. Are you getting it? These are not three separate devices. This is one device.
And backstage, Apple's engineering team is holding their collective breath because the device in Jobs' hand is running a demo that's been rehearsed hundreds of times along a single scripted route they call the Golden Path. One wrong tap, one deviation from the script, and the whole thing crashes. They've hard-coded the signal bars to show 5 bars regardless of actual signal strength. The wireless mic is a specific choice to avoid audio input crashes. This isn't a product demo. It's a magic trick performed on a device that barely works.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything. That's what Jobs said before the reveal. He was right. But nobody in that room, not even Jobs, understood how right. Welcome back to Silicon Valley Strategy. I'm Myra D'Amico.
And I'm Travis Carlisle. This is Episode 6. So that moment we just described, Jobs on stage, the golden path running backstage, a magic trick performed on hardware that barely works, that's the launch of the most profitable product in the history of capitalism.
And we're doing Apple Part 2 today. Last episode, we took Apple through the founding, the Macintosh, the wilderness years, the firing of Jobs. Today, we pick up with the return, and we take it all the way through to the most profitable product in the history of capitalism.
I mean, which I think it's worth stating plainly, is the iPhone. Not the most profitable technology product, the most profitable product, period. The cumulative profit generated by the iPhone since 2007 exceeds the GDP of most countries.
So before we dive in, trivia. And this one is about the moment Steve Jobs came back to Apple. Listeners, here's the question. When Jobs returned to Apple in 1997, how close was the company to running out of money, and what's the first thing he did to the product line?
Great question. And the answer is more dramatic than people realize.
Lee, if you're playing along, pause now. The answer? Apple had 90 days of cash left. 90 days. That's not a metaphor. That's what Jobs himself said when he surveyed the financials. The company was selling roughly 70 different products, most of which were losing money, most of which competed against each other. Jobs walked in and killed all but four. He drew a 2x2 matrix on a whiteboard, consumer and professional on one axis, desktop and portable on the other, and said, "We're making 4 products. Everything else dies."
And here's the number that makes my head spin. Michael Dell, when asked what he'd do with Apple, said, "I'd shut it down and give the money back to the shareholders." Apple is now worth roughly 50 times what Dell Technologies is worth. That quote aged like milk left on a hot sidewalk.
To be fair, in 1997, it was a reasonable take.
It was a reasonable take, and that's what makes it so instructive. 36 products canceled, thousands of engineers reassigned or let go. In one meeting, Jobs destroyed more product lines than most companies ever create. And I don't think the strategic logic gets enough analytical attention. This isn't just cost-cutting, it's focus. And focus in a resource-constrained environment, 90 days of cash, is the single highest leverage strategic move available. Every dollar and every engineer concentrated on 4 products instead of 40 means 10 times the quality per product. That's not a marginal improvement. That's a category shift.
You know what this reminds me of? The Fairchild story from episode 1. How the traitorous 8 were brilliant engineers but had 0 equity, 0 ownership of the thing they built. Jobs comes back and the first thing he does is make the product feel like it belongs to you. The iMac ships in 1998. Bondi blue, translucent, no floppy drive. The handle on top was a deliberate psychological choice. Jonathan Ive said the handle gave people permission to touch the computer. Fairchild's founders couldn't even own their own company. Jobs made customers feel like they owned their computer through a handle and a few dollars of plastic.
The emotional design of ownership. It runs through this entire history.
All right, let's set the stage properly. Because the Apple Part II story really starts in 1997, and the broader context matters.
Apple is 90 days from bankruptcy. That's not hyperbole. It's what Jobs said. The stock is trading around 10 cents a share, split adjusted. And the broader tech landscape is entering the internet era. Netscape has IPO'd. Amazon has just gone public. The web browser is becoming the platform. There's a genuine question about whether operating systems even matter anymore. If everything runs in a browser, who cares if you're on Windows or Mac?
Which makes what Jobs does even more counterintuitive. He doesn't pivot Apple to the internet. He doesn't try to build a browser. He goes back to hardware. He goes back to the physical product.
I need people to sit with that. In 1997, the conventional wisdom is that software and the internet are eating everything. Hardware is a commodity. We literally just did the Dell and Compaq episode where the entire lesson was that PC hardware commoditizes. And Jobs bets the company on hardware. He bets on atoms, not bits. And he turns out to be right. Because his insight is that hardware isn't a commodity when you control the entire experience. When every layer of the stack, from the industrial design to the operating system to the content store, is optimized to work together. A Dell is a commodity because it runs the same Windows as every other box. An iMac isn't a commodity because nothing else looks like it, feels like it, or works like it.
And the results came fast. 800,000 iMacs sold in the first 5 months. Apple is alive. But what happens next is the move that transforms Apple from a computer company into something else entirely. October 2001, the iPod. 1,000 songs in your pocket, 5 GB hard drive, scroll wheel interface, FireWire syncing. The device itself is beautiful, but the insight isn't the device. The insight is the full stack.
And I want to tell a story that captures how obsessively Jobs approached the hardware side. The original iPod prototype comes back from the engineering team, and Jobs thinks it's too big. He takes the prototype and drops it into a fish tank, right in front of the engineers. Bubbles rise to the surface. "Those are air pockets," he says. "There's space in there. You can make it smaller."
He threw it in a fish tank.
He threw it in a fish tank, and the engineers went back and made it smaller. That's the level of obsession we're talking about. But here's what separates Jobs from every other hardware executive of the era. There were other MP3 players. The Rio existed. The Creative Nomad existed. They could play music. The difference is that Jobs understood the product wasn't the device. The product was the experience of acquiring, organizing, and listening to music. And that experience required a device, software, and content, all working together.
So let's actually break down the iTunes Store negotiation, because it's a masterclass in sequenced leverage. Jobs goes to the record labels, Universal, Sony, Warner, EMI, BMG, and he needs to convince them to sell individual songs for 99 cents each through a digital store. The labels hate this idea. They sell albums for $15 to $18. Individual song sales cannibalize album revenue.
So how does he get them to agree?
Three moves in sequence. First, he negotiates each label separately. He doesn't let them organize a collective response. He picks the most desperate label first, I believe it was Universal, and gets them to commit. Then he goes to the next one with momentum. Universal is already in. You can't afford to be the one label that's not.
Classic divide and conquer.
Second, he limits the initial launch to Mac only. In 2003, Mac has maybe 2 to 3% market share. So the labels aren't threatened. They're giving away digital rights on a platform that barely exists. The risk to their physical album sales is negligible.
And Jobs knows this. He's deliberately minimizing the perceived threat to get the terms he wants. He knows he's going to expand to Windows later, but he doesn't tell the labels that.
Third, and this is the part that's genuinely Machiavellian, the terms he negotiates on Mac are the terms that carry over when he launches on Windows. By the time the iTunes Store opens on Windows in October 2003, Apple already has the contractual framework established. The labels can't renegotiate without walking away from a platform that's already generating real revenue.
And I love this part because, run the math on what happened. The labels gave Apple the right to disaggregate their product, price it at a level that cannibalized physical sales, and distribute it through a channel that Apple controlled. In exchange, they got revenue that was a fraction of what CDs generated. The labels were so focused on the threat of piracy, Napster, LimeWire, that they gave away the store to the one company that could end piracy. Jobs solved their piracy problem and charged them for the solution.
It's one of the great negotiation sequences in business history, and the labels never recovered.
And here's where the flywheel starts to emerge. iTunes takes 70% of the legal digital music market within a year. 70%. But more importantly, once you've bought 100 songs on iTunes, all in Apple's FairPlay DRM format, moving to a different music player means abandoning your entire library. Your music collection becomes a lock-in mechanism. Every song you buy makes the lock deeper.
More iPod users means more iTunes purchases. More iTunes purchases means higher switching costs. Higher switching costs means more iPod loyalty. More iPod loyalty means Apple has more leverage with the labels. The negotiation win wasn't a one-time event. It was the first turn of a flywheel that's still spinning 20 years later.
And this is where the labels should have seen it coming. Every concession Jobs extracted was individually small. Mac only, just 99 cents, just digital, just individual tracks. But compounded over time, those individually small concessions added up to Apple owning the primary distribution channel for the entire music industry. Sequential leverage. Each step was small enough to accept. The cumulative result was a revolution.
Which brings us to the iPhone. Because the iPod flywheel taught Jobs something crucial. If you control the content distribution layer, you control the customer relationship. And he's about to apply that exact lesson to an industry 100 times larger than music.
In 2006, every mobile phone in America is controlled by the carrier. Verizon, AT&T, Sprint, T-Mobile, they dictate what software is on the phone, what apps are pre-installed, what the home screen looks like. The carrier owns the customer relationship. The phone manufacturer is essentially a commodity supplier building to carrier specifications. Nokia, Motorola, Samsung, they all built what the carriers told them to build.
And Jobs walks into AT&T, then known as Singular, which had recently rebranded as AT&T Wireless, and says, "We're going to make a phone. You won't put any of your software on it. You won't pre-install any apps. You won't control the user interface. Apple controls everything about the software experience. Oh, and Apple gets a share of the monthly service revenue."
The audacity of this is hard to overstate. No manufacturer had ever demanded these terms, and AT&T said yes. Why? Because they were desperate for subscriber growth. They calculated that an exclusive deal with the iPhone would be such a powerful customer acquisition tool that it was worth giving up control.
And they were right about customer acquisition. The iPhone exclusivity drove millions of new subscribers to AT&T. What they were wrong about was the long-term power dynamics. Once consumers started buying iPhones for AT&T, the carrier became the replaceable component. People didn't switch to AT&T for AT&T, they switched for the iPhone. Apple owned the customer relationship.
And here's an insider detail that captures the engineering side of this story. The original iPhone didn't even have 3G. It was running on AT&T's Pokey Edge network, the same slow data speeds as a flip phone. And Jobs knew the network experience would be mediocre, but he also knew it didn't matter. The demo was the product. The touch interface, the visual voicemail, Safari in your pocket, that's what people were buying. The carriers thought they were selling connectivity. Jobs understood he was selling a computer that happened to make calls.
What gets me about this deal is the structural reversal. Before the iPhone, carriers had all the power and manufacturers were commodities. After the iPhone, Apple had all the power and carriers were pipes. One product flipped a multi-100-billion-dollar industry's power structure.
And it's worth comparing this to the music industry reversal. Jobs did the exact same thing twice. In music, he turned the labels from kingmakers into suppliers. In mobile, he turned the carriers from gatekeepers into pipes. Same playbook. Build a product so compelling that the incumbent has to partner on your terms, then use the partnership to capture the customer relationship. The product is always the leverage.
And by the time the carriers realized what had happened, it was too late. the iPhone had enough market power that carriers had to offer it on Apple's terms or lose subscribers to whichever carrier did. Apple turned the carrier's competitive pressure against them.
If you're a founder listening to this right now, thinking about your industry's power structure, ask yourself, is there a product so compelling that it could invert who has leverage? Because in 2006, nobody believed a phone manufacturer could dictate terms to a carrier. The structural reversal felt impossible, right up until the moment it happened.
That's the thing about power structures. They feel permanent until they're not.
And that connects to what happened next, which is even more consequential than the iPhone itself. Here's a fact that surprises people. Steve Jobs initially opposed native third-party apps on the iPhone. At launch in June 2007, his position was that developers should build web apps, applications that ran in Safari, no native app store, no downloadable software.
Wait, really? Jobs, the man who just pulled off the most visionary product launch in a generation, didn't want an app store?
He didn't. And Scott Forstall, who was running the iPhone software team, spent months making the internal case for a native app platform. He argued that web apps were too limited, that developers needed access to the hardware, that an app ecosystem would be the thing that made the iPhone indispensable. And the fact that Forstall pushed back for months on Steve Jobs, the man who threw iPod prototypes into fish tanks, tells you how strongly the team believed in native apps.
I mean, think about the dynamic there. This is Steve Jobs, the man who exercises a level of product control that borders on pathological, and Forstall keeps pushing for months until Jobs relents. That tells you everything about how important the App Store idea was to the people closest to the product.
Jobs eventually relents. The App Store launches in July 2008 with 500 apps and a 30% take rate. Apple keeps 30 cents of every dollar spent. By the end of the first weekend, 10 million apps have been downloaded.
And this is where the flywheel really starts to roar. More users buy iPhones, more developers build apps. Because there are more users, more apps make the iPhone more valuable. More people buy iPhones. It's a two-sided marketplace where both sides are accelerating each other. And once that loop starts spinning, it's nearly impossible to stop.
And the economics are staggering. By 2023, the App Store is generating somewhere between $85 and $90 billion in annual billings. Apple's 30% cut means roughly $25 to $27 billion in revenue from a marketplace that has essentially zero marginal cost to operate. The infrastructure is already built. Every additional app sale drops almost entirely to the bottom line.
And now think about the take rate for a second. 30%. Apple takes 30 cents of every dollar that flows through the App Store. Every game purchase, every subscription, every in-app upgrade. That's a tax on an entire economy. And the economy can't leave, because the switching costs for both developers and users are enormous.
Well, let me walk through those switching costs, because they're the key to understanding why nobody's been able to crack this. For developers, you've built your app in Apple's programming language, using Apple's development tools, optimized for Apple's hardware. Porting to Android is a full rewrite. Your App Store reviews, your download rankings, your customer relationships, none of that transfers. For users, your purchased apps, your saved data, your subscriptions, your family sharing, all locked to the Apple ecosystem.
Windows Phone, BlackBerry, Amazon Fire Phone, all tried to break in, all dead. Microsoft alone spent billions on Windows Phone. They bought Nokia, they had infinite resources and infinite determination, and it didn't matter. Because you'd need to simultaneously attract enough users to make developers care and enough developers to make users care. That's a chicken and egg problem that's defeated every competitor so far.
Now here's where Apple makes the really important strategic transition. iPhone unit sales peak in 2015 at roughly 231 million units. Replacement cycles start lengthening. People are keeping their phones for 3, 4, 5 years instead of upgrading every 2. If Apple is a hardware company, this is a growth problem.
But Apple isn't just a hardware company anymore. It's a hardware company that monetizes an installed base through recurring services. App Store, Apple Music, iCloud Storage, Apple TV+, Apple Pay, Apple Care. Each of these services generates recurring revenue from the existing installed base. The phone is the acquisition mechanism. The services are the monetization mechanism.
And that distinction, treating the installed base not as a customer list but as a market, is the conceptual shift that turned Apple into the most valuable company in the world. Because a customer list depreciates. Customers age out, switch, stop buying. But a market compounds. You add more monetization surfaces, app store, services, accessories, financing, and the revenue per user grows even as unit sales flatten.
And then there's the Google deal. This one doesn't get enough attention. Google pays Apple somewhere between $18 and $20 billion a year to be the default search engine on Safari. That's nearly pure profit for Apple. Apple doesn't do anything to earn it, except maintain the installed base. Google pays because access to a billion iPhone users is worth $20 billion a year in search advertising revenue. The installed base is the asset. Google is paying rent on it.
Wait, I want to make sure people absorb that number. $18 to $20 billion per year for being the default. That's not a product. That's not a service Apple builds or maintains in any meaningful way. That's a toll Apple collects because a billion people use iPhones, and the default search engine is the one most people use. It's the purest expression of installed base economics in the history of business.
And every layer of integration deepens the switching costs further. An iPhone user who wants to switch to Android doesn't just switch phones. They lose their iMessage group chats, which for teenagers and young adults is a genuine social cost. They lose AirDrop. They lose the seamless integration with their MacBook, their Apple Watch, their AirPods. They lose their iCloud photo library. They lose their purchased apps.
And this isn't accidental. Each of these integration points was designed to be slightly better within the Apple ecosystem than across ecosystems. iMessage is deliberately not available on Android. AirDrop only works between Apple devices. These aren't technical limitations. They're strategic choices that increase the cost of switching.
No single switching cost is insurmountable. You could migrate your photos. You could rebuy your apps. You could text with SMS instead of iMessage. But the aggregate switching cost, all of those frictions combined, is enormous. Apple doesn't need any one lock-in mechanism to be overwhelming. They need the sum of all the small lock-in mechanisms to exceed the threshold of action.
Death by a thousand paper cuts, except you inflict the cuts on yourself if you leave.
That's a dark way to put it, but yeah.
And then there's Apple Silicon. In 2020, Apple announces it's designing its own processors, ARM-based chips, the M1 family, replacing Intel processors that had been in Macs since 2006. The performance per watt advantage is immediate and dramatic. The M1 MacBook Air had no fan and outperformed Intel-based MacBook Pros. By designing its own silicon, Apple eliminates Intel's margin from its bill of materials, controls the performance roadmap, and differentiates its hardware in a way that no competitor running commodity chips can match.
It's the final piece of the full-stack integration story. From the transistor to the App Store, Apple controls every layer. No other company in the industry has that kind of vertical integration. Every layer of the stack that Apple controls is a layer where a competitor can't differentiate. And every layer generates margin that Apple captures instead of paying to a supplier.
If you're loving this analysis of how Apple built a full-stack monopoly, the online course at SVStrategy.xyz lets you explore these dynamics interactively. There are AI-powered role-play scenarios where you negotiate deals like the AT&T-Apple partnership, plus era context and the full 70-year timeline of Silicon Valley. That's SV, short for Silicon Valley, strategy.xyz.
SVStrategy.xyz. Go check it out.
So let me pull the analysis into frameworks. And I want to be precise because I think people get the Apple story wrong in a specific way.
Go.
Framework 1, sequential leverage in negotiations. The iTunes Store negotiation, the AT&T deal, the App Store terms. In every case, Jobs structured the deal to minimize the perceived threat at the moment of signing, then expanded the scope after the terms were locked in. He gave the labels a Mac-only store, then went to Windows. He gave AT&T an exclusive, then opened to all carriers. He launched the iPhone with web apps, then shifted to native. Each step was small enough to accept. The cumulative result was a revolution. And the key insight is that revolutionary outcomes don't require revolutionary negotiations. They require a sequence of individually reasonable negotiations that compound into a revolutionary position.
I mean, and the counter lesson for anyone on the other side of the table, don't evaluate each deal in isolation. Evaluate the trajectory. Ask where this sequence of individually reasonable concessions leads if extended to its logical conclusion. The labels didn't ask that question. The carriers didn't ask that question. And by the time the answer was obvious, the leverage had shifted.
Framework 2, the installed base as a market. This is the conceptual shift that I think is the most important strategic insight in the Apple story. Most companies treat their customers as a list, a set of people who've bought the product and might buy the next version. Apple treats its installed base as a market, a population that can be monetized through an expanding portfolio of services, accessories, subscriptions, and third-party tolls like the Google search deal. The difference is existential. A list depreciates. A market compounds. The strategic question isn't how many customers do you have, it's what else can you sell them? If the answer is nothing, your customer base is a depreciating asset. If the answer is an expanding portfolio of services, it's a compounding asset.
And the math on this is extraordinary. The Google search deal alone generates more profit than most Fortune 500 companies generate in total revenue. Apple didn't build a search engine. They built an installed base so large that the world's largest search engine pays them $20 billion a year for default access. That's the installed base's market framework at its most extreme.
Framework 3, full stack integration as flywheel. The lesson of Apple under Jobs, and this carries through to the Tim Cook era, is that the product isn't the device. The product is the experience. And to control the experience, you need to control every layer of the stack. The silicon, the hardware, the operating system, the applications, the services, the retail. Each layer you control is a layer where you can optimize for the user and capture margin. Each layer you delegate to a third party is a layer where someone else's priorities and someone else's margin get inserted into your product. But the deeper point is that each layer reinforces the others. Apple Silicon makes the hardware faster, which makes the software experience better, which attracts more users, which attracts more developers, which builds the App Store, which generates services revenue, which funds more silicon R&D. It's a flywheel where every layer accelerates every other layer.
I want to be careful here because full stack integration isn't always the right strategy. It requires enormous capital, enormous talent, and the ability to be excellent at many different disciplines simultaneously. Most companies can't do it. Apple can because of the specific combination of design culture, engineering depth, and cash flow from the iPhone business. This isn't a generalizable playbook. This is a playbook that works if you're Apple. All right. If you're running a company, any company, not just a tech company, what do you take from the Apple Part 2 story?
First, your existing customers are your most valuable asset, and the way you monetize them should evolve as your business matures. Apple could have remained a hardware company and fought the replacement cycle problem with cheaper phones, faster upgrade incentives, aggressive trade-in programs. Instead, they changed the question from how do we sell more iPhones to how do we generate more revenue per iPhone user. That reframe is worth hundreds of billions of dollars in market capitalization.
Second, switching costs are cumulative and they should be designed intentionally. Apple didn't build one overwhelming lock-in mechanism. They built dozens of small ones. iMessage, AirDrop, iCloud, Apple Watch integration, FaceTime, the AirPods pairing experience, each of which is individually surmountable but collectively enormous. If you're designing a product ecosystem, the question isn't what's our lock-in? It's how many small frictions can we create that compound into an insurmountable switching cost?
And the third lesson is about product as leverage. In every major negotiation Apple conducted, with the labels, with AT&T, with developers, the leverage came from the product, not from market power, not from financial muscle, from the fact that the iPod and the iPhone were products so compelling that the other side of the table had to participate on Apple's terms. The product is always the leverage. If you build something people desperately want, you can dictate terms. If you don't, No amount of negotiation skill saves you.
All right, let's land this. What are the key takeaways from Apple Part 2?
Number one, an installed base is a market, not a list. The strategic question isn't how many customers you have, but what else you can sell them. Apple's services transition, from hardware-dominated revenue to services-augmented revenue, changes every financial metric. Margins go up, revenue predictability goes up, customer lifetime value goes up, and Wall Street rewards recurring revenue with higher multiples. So the services transition isn't just operationally valuable, it changes how investors value the company.
Number two, full stack control is the ultimate moat if you can execute it. Every layer of the stack you control is a layer where competitors can't differentiate and where you capture margin. Apple Silicon eliminated Intel's margin from the bill of materials. The App Store captures 30% of every transaction. The retail stores own the customer relationship. Each layer compounds the advantage of every other layer. That's what Helmer would call stacked powers. Scale economies in the App Store's fixed cost infrastructure, switching costs in the ecosystem lock-in, counter-positioning against every competitor who can't replicate the full stack.
Number three, switching costs are cumulative and should be layered intentionally. No single integration point, iMessage, AirDrop, iCloud, is enough to lock in a customer. But the aggregate of dozens of small integration points creates a switching cost that exceeds the threshold of action for most users. The lesson isn't to build one overwhelming lock-in mechanism. It's to build many small ones that compound. That's switching costs, as Helmer defines them, the friction that makes it expensive or painful for a customer to leave.
Number four, and this is the one I keep thinking about. The most important product decision Steve Jobs made when he returned to Apple was not what to build. It was what to kill. Canceling all but four of roughly 70 product lines was the precondition for everything that followed. Without that focus, there's no iMac, no iPod, no iPhone. Apple had 90 days of cash and 70 products. Jobs walked in and said, four. That discipline, the willingness to kill over 60 products, is rarer than the vision to launch one great one. And Apple had both.
And number five, counterpositioning can flip entire industries. The carriers couldn't cede control to Apple without becoming dumb pipes. The labels couldn't match iTunes without cannibalizing album sales. In every negotiation, Jobs found the structural reason the incumbent couldn't respond. That's not just good deal-making, that's strategy. The product is always the leverage. That might be the single best sentence summary of the Apple story. Before we sign off, if the Apple negotiation sequences blew your mind, the online course at svstrategy.exyz has a mystery company simulation for this era, where you're running a hardware company negotiating with carriers and content partners, plus full podcast transcripts with section navigation. That's svstrategy.xyz.
svstrategy.xyz. That's the story of Apple Part 2. Next time, the dot-com bubble, where almost nobody had either.
See you next time.